Side 8, An Agent in Place by Robert Little, continuing on page 284.
What was an empty army truck doing at some godforsaken station? And where were the soldiers who had driven it there?
Manny bolted upright, awakening Sava.
Where are you going? The boy whispered when he saw Manny step over the man sleeping on the floor and start to ease open the compartment door.
To stretch my legs, Manny whispered back. Sliding the door closed behind him, he made his way down the corridor, stepping over the sleeping figures huddled in blankets on the floor. He hauled open the door at the end of the car and hauled it closed behind him, and standing with a foot on each car, stared at the tracks rushing past under his feet before moving on to the next car. Threading his way over and around the sleeping figures, he worked his way from car to car back toward the rear of the train. Three cars from the caboose, he spotted what he was afraid he would find. Up ahead, he could see six men, four armed with rifles and dressed in the uniforms and berets of KGB border guard, two in civilian raincoats and fedoras, making their way down the corridor, kicking awake the Armenians sprawled on the floor, flinging open compartment doors and reaching in to rouse those inside. While the border guards scrutinized identity papers, the two civilians compared the faces of the Armenians with photographs they held in their hands. Manny turned and scrambled back to his own car near the head of the train. He scratched his fingernails on the glass door of Ben's compartment. Ben's eyes flitted open. Manny jerked his head sharply. Ben eased Aida's head off his shoulder and came out into the corridor. "What's up?" he whispered. Manny explained what he had seen. "They're waking everyone and checking identity papers." "Oh, my God," Ben exclaimed. He had a sudden vision of Aida and the boy being marched off at the point of bayonets and clutched at a straw. "We have identity papers." Manny shook his head. "The heavies in raincoats have photographs. Maybe they're not looking for us." "Maybe they are." Manny glanced out the window, trying to judge the train's speed. He wondered how much trains slowed down on curves. He wondered if Aida and the boy could survive if they jumped from it. Behind Ben, a door slid open, and the elf-like man who shared the compartment with Ben and Aida stepped into the corridor. He took in the grim expression on Manny's lips and the wild look in Ben's eyes.
"There is surely an alternative to jumping from the train," he said clearly.
He smiled a conspiratorial smile.
"If you please, when you do sums," he said, addressing Ben, "what language do you count in?"
"Russian," Ben answered. The man reached up with a forefinger and pulled down on the skin under an eye, a sign that he did not believe Ben.
"The Russians may have taken you for Armenians, but we Armenians did not take you for Armenians. We were onto you as soon as you walked into our compartment. My wife's sisters think the woman and the boy are Russian Jews trying to wend their way to Israel. As for you and your friend here, my wife thinks you are Turks. My sons say you are Germans or Hollanders. I myself have a 10-ruble wager with my sister-in-law that you count in English."
He switched into English himself.
1, 2, 3, 3.5, 3 3/4, and so forth and so on. I am a professor of algebra. I was correct about you counting in English, yes?
This time Ben didn't deny it.
"Not to worry," the elf-like man said quickly. "Nobody on this train will betray you to the Russian. On the contrary, we will help you if it is within our power. Explain me, if you please, where is the problem?"
Ben looked at Manny. With a shrug of his heavy shoulders, Manny turned to the Armenian teacher of algebra and told him about the border guards and the KGB agents in civilian clothing and the photographs. The elf-like man's two sons and wife and two sisters, hearing conversation in the corridor, came up behind him. Up and down the corridor, Armenians sleeping in blankets stirred. The elf-like man repeated to his family what Manny had told him. Two older Armenians joined the group. Four more came up behind them. Soon, all were babbling in Armenian. The teacher of algebra turned back to Manny.
"My wife, always practical, asks how long before the KGB whores arrive us."
"At the rate they are going, maybe 3/4 of an hour, maybe less." The elf-like man repeated this to his wife. There was another burst of conversation in Armenian. The wife, clearly strong-willed, was insisting on something.
One of the men who had joined the group pulled a large silver pocket watch from a vest pocket and made a short speech. The Armenians nodded. The teacher of algebra issued instructions to his sons. One set off toward the head of the train, the other in the direction of the advancing border guards. Drawn by the commotion, Aida appeared at the door of the compartment. "What is happening?" she called. "Do not be frightened, dear lady," the elf-like man told Aida in Russian. "You will get to Israel yet." Switching to English, he addressed Ben and Manny. "Please, this gentleman says me that he was born in Voronezh and knows the area like the palm of his hand. In 15 minutes, maybe more, maybe less, the train will cross a bridge over a river. Immediately we have crossed, I personally will pull the emergency cord. My two sons are alerting people. When the train stops, everyone will descend off the wagons to stretch legs, to, excuse the expression, urinate, to wash in the river. Prepare yourself. Fill your pockets with food, but do not take valises with you. There will be a disturbance at the front of the train. The KGB whores will be distracted. Make your way under the bridge and stay there when the whistle sounds. When the train has left, follow the river. The gentleman who was born in Voronezh says me, if you walk for 2 days, you will come to where the river empties into the Don. And the Don empties into the Sea of Azov, which in turn empties into the Black Sea, and the Black Sea empties into the Mediterranean. Aida brought a hand to her heart. From our hearts, we thank you all. The elf-like man turned toward her. If you please, there is no need to thank us. We are a people who trace our roots back to Noah. We believe in God. Go with God if you share our belief in God. Half bowing in her direction, the elf-like man added, Go with him, even if you do not. The locomotive's whistle dispatched a plaintive shriek over the deserted wasteland in which the train had come to a stop. On signal, one family near the front of the train accused another of stealing food. Words, then blows were exchanged. The women, screaming insults, joined the fray. The train's regular guards and the KGB border guards trotted off to see what the commotion was all about. But the two KGB agents in raincoats and fedoras hung back near the caboose, eyeing the Armenians suspiciously, waiting to make sure that everyone who had left the train got back on board. The elf-like professor of algebra and his practical wife conversed in urgent undertones. Then the wife, making her way back along the line of cars, marched straight up to the younger of the two KGB agents and slapped him sharply across the face. The other KGB man roughly pushed her away as she yelled something about the KGB having murdered her grandfather. Other Armenians drifted over and hurled accusations of their own. Backed up against the side of the caboose by the shouting Armenians, the younger KGB man panicked and tugged a pistol from his raincoat pocket. Near the middle of the train, the algebra teacher nodded at Ben. Manny grabbed Sava's hand and pulled him under the train and out the other side. Aida and Ben scrambled under the train behind them. Quick! Manny called in a ruthless whisper as he scampered down an embankment, and moving with surprising speed for someone of his bulk, darted along a narrow drainage ditch toward the bridge. As they came abreast of the caboose, they could hear the furious shouts of the KGB men ordering the Armenians to back off. A dry crack of a pistol shot rang out, and a high-pitched voice cried, "The next bullet won't be fired into the air!" At the bridge, there was a steep, loose-pebbled incline down to the river. Anchoring himself with his left arm around the stump of a dead tree, Manny passed Sava to Ben, who was already halfway down the incline. Keeping a grip on Sava's hand, Ben eased him down the rest of the way. Then he skidded to the bottom after him. Aida and Manny slid down the incline, and the four of them, breathing hard, ducked under the bridge and flattened themselves against the wall. Presently, they heard the thud of boots on the ties over their heads and the muffled voices of the KGB border guards taking a last look around. There was another plaintive shriek of the train's whistle. The KGB guards started back toward the caboose. Moments later, several cars banged against each other as the train jerked forward. With Manny leading the way, the group, moving parallel to the river, started out across fields of crabgrass. They skirted a large herd of sheep being shooed along by two teenage boys riding ponies and later in the day made a detour around a tractor station for a collective farm. The first night, they slept in an abandoned stone shelter that had traces of previous fires in its makeshift chimney. Aida and Sava gathered dry twigs and lit a small fire. Manny used Sava's Swiss Army knife to cut slices of bread and goat cheese for everyone. Cradling Sava's head on her lap, Aida seemed mesmerized by the points of flame dancing from the burning wood. Manny spread his raincoat over the sleeping boy. Aida smiled her thanks. With Manny snoring away in a corner, Ben settled down next to Aida. He touched her wristwatch with the tip of a finger.
I would walk through fire if I could go back in time and fix things so that things didn't need to be fixed, he whispered.
There was a forlorn half-smile on Aida's lips as she murmured, I would walk through fire if I could go back in time and fix things so that we never met. If anything happens to Sava, she turned away and shut her eyes. They were off again before dawn the next morning, stumbling through woods in the darkness, clambering at first light over crumbling stone walls glistening with dew. Attempting to skirt a giant marshland where the river had overflowed a bank, they lost their bearings. Manny was sure the river was behind them, Ben thought it was somewhere off to their left. They turned in circles for hours, meandering through an endless scrub, clawing their way through fields of thick brambles, wandering into a wood, finally sinking exhausted to the ground in a clearing. Overhead, billowing clouds choked off the sun. Always on the alert for omens, Aida took it as an ominous sign. We will never reach the dawn, she moaned. She pulled the edge of her skirt out from under her belt and moistened it with saliva and began to clean the scratches on Sava's arms and legs. Suddenly, two shots echoed through the woods. Overhead, dozens of birds fluttered in fright into the sky. Manny rose to one knee. Aida wrapped her arms around Sava and held him to her. The crack of dry twigs reverberated through the silent woods. Two figures approached. The man leading the way had a dark, hawk-like face and was wearing a wide-brimmed felt hat, loose-fitting trousers and shirt, knee-length boots, and a short green cape. A slender teenager dressed in a loose-fitting blouse and blue jeans and scuffed lace-up hunting boots trailed behind him. Each carried a shotgun slung under an armpit. The man in the green cape stopped in his tracks when he spotted the four people in the clearing. "Who are you?" he called in a tone that made it seem as if he owned the woods. "Where do you come from?" The teenager let the butt of the shotgun slide out from under his armpit so that he was holding the weapon loosely with both hands. He said something to the older man in a dialect. Aida whispered excitedly, "They are gypsies!" She rose to her feet. "So, we are trying to escape from the Soviet police," she told the man in the green cape. "For what crime are you being pursued?" the man called. "For the crime of independence of spirit," she responded. A thin smile appeared on the gypsy's face. He snapped a command in dialect. The teenage boy's shotgun slid back under his armpit. Holding on to Sava's hand, pulling him along with her, Aida took several steps in the direction of the man in the green cape. "We escaped yesterday from a train being guarded by frontier police with KGB badges." At the mention of KGB, the gypsy turned his head and spat on the ground. "We were following the river in the hope of reaching the dawn when we got lost," Aida added. "The river bends back on itself in a giant S at the marshland," the gypsy called. He raised a hand and pointed off to his right. "It is there, beyond the woods. If you walk like a gypsy and follow the river and cut across the fields where it bends back on itself, you will arrive by nightfall at the place where it flows into the Don." Manny came up behind Aida. "Ask him if there are boats on the Don," he muttered. Aida repeated the question. The gypsy replied that until the river froze over, maybe 20, maybe 25 flat-bottomed scows passed every day, almost all of them heading for Rostov with cargoes that would eventually wind up on freighters in the port. Ben whispered, "The gypsy is the answer to our prayers." Slipping a hand into his inside breast pocket and fingering a wad of bills, Manny said under his breath, "Ask him if he will guide us to the Don and arrange passage for us on one of these scows." The gypsy must have sensed that Manny was reaching for a wallet because he raised a palm in warning. "Tell him money left in a pocket offends no one. Tell him there is nothing we want that we cannot steal. Tell him also that stealing from Bolsheviks is not a crime." Then, his eyes flashing with pride, the gypsy announced that he and his son would guide them to the dawn. "We gypsies have a proverb," he called. "The best of friends is the enemy of your enemy." Its motor thumping, its decks creaking under the load of bales of cotton, the yellow-hulled riverboat slipped with the current of the dawn past the vineyards on either bank toward the city Aida called Temerniskaya Tambozhnya, and the captain of the riverboat called Rostov-na-Donu, Rostov on Don. Late in the afternoon, the roofs of buildings could be seen in the distance. The captain eased the boat against the higher of the two banks. "The customs house is around the next bend," he called from the wheelhouse. Clutching a line, Ben leaped ashore from the bow and held the boat against the bank so the others could jump off. Manny went aft and handed the captain $3 $20 bills.
"I have never seen such money before," the captain wheezed. "What country did you say it came from?"
"America the Beautiful," Manny told him. "In that case," the old captain replied, "you have given me far too much. On the black market, each of these pieces of paper is worth what I am paid for an entire month." "Keep it, old man," Manny said. "No need to mention us to the customs people, is there?" The captain tucked the money inside the sweatband of his faded blue cap. "No need at all," he agreed heartily. He pulled an old customs manifest from a cardboard box, and wetting the stub of a pencil on his tongue, wrote on the back, "Go to the palace of the circus of Budinovsky Prospekt. Ask for Madame Sofiko, the tattooed woman." The captain handed Manny the paper. "Say Zurab sent you. If you give her some of those pretty bills, she will find a place for you to lay your heads while you do whatever it is you have come to Rostov-na-Donu to do." Skirting the customs house, a blockhouse-like concrete building on the edge of the river, Ben and Aida and Manny and the boy picked their way through the maze of vegetable gardens and tool sheds north of Rostov. They waited in the shadow of a tool shed until darkness fell before entering the city. A cool breeze swept in from the river. The streets, set out in a grid, were wide and spotless, and lined with the usual assortment of rambling brick buildings that characterized Soviet rural architecture. Aida and Ben and Sava, armed with some of Manny's $10 bills, went off in one direction to find the circus palace and the tattooed woman, Madame Sofiko. Manny consulted a street corner plan of the city and set off toward the Sea of Azov Hotel on the corner of Prospekt Karl Marx and Pushkin Street, the last known address he had for the brothers Karamazov, the Cossack smugglers who had run his agents across the Soviet frontier during his back-to-back tours for the CIA in Turkey. The original Sea of Azov Hotel had been reduced to rubble in the violent battles of the Great Patriotic War, during which the city had changed hands several times. From the ashes of the old hotel had risen a Soviet monster, a building with a marble facade and Palladian pillars on either side of the main entrance, and turrets at the four corners. Manny, who had never been to the hotel, but had described it in intimate detail to dozens of agents, ambled past the reception desk down a long corridor to the dark, stale-smelling saloon at the back. He walked over to the bar and plunked down a 10-ruble bill. "Vodka," he told the bartender. When the vodka had been measured out and set before him, Manny waved away the change. "I am looking for the Kapitonov brothers," he announced. The bartender shrugged. If he knew the Kapitonov brothers, he was not admitting it. Manny coughed up a guttural laugh as he dropped a 50-franc note onto the bar. The bartender, a slim young man with slicked-back hair and an insolent glint in his eyes, examined the bill. "Which of the brothers do you want, Gennady or Fyodor?" "Their names are Kirill and Konstantin," Manny muttered. "Either one will do. In the unlikely event I come across a Kirill or a Konstantin, what do I tell them?" "Say a friend from Istanbul would like to see them. Say I used to go by the name of Pressman." The bartender ducked through a door behind the bar. After a moment, he reappeared at the door and gestured to Manny with his head. Manny came around behind the bar. The bartender nodded toward the interior of the room. Manny pushed through the door. The room was thick with cigar smoke. Through the haze, Manny could make out two men leaning forward, slapping domino chips onto a low table. When the door closed behind Manny, one of the two players, a fat man crammed into a wicker wheelchair, let his gaze stray to the visitor.
Have we met before? He asked, lazily sucking on the soggy end of a thick cigar.
Manny took a step toward the fat man in the wheelchair, but stopped when he saw the young man at the table half rise out of his seat.
We have not met, Manny said, but our paths have crossed more than 200 times. If you went by the name of Pressman, you will know by what name my brother and I were called, since you were the one to assign us the name. You were the brothers Karamazov.
A benign smile spread across the fat man's fat face. He wheeled his chair around to face Manny. You were a legend in your time. The few who came face to face with you said you had a habit of laughing when you were afraid. They said you hardly ever laughed. Who would have believed our paths would cross after all these years?
It's a strange world, Manny agreed. What is your brother up to these days?
Kirill has been safely dead and safely buried since the summer.
Did he die a natural death?
He died a death that for him was natural. A Turk and he were running guns across the border to the Shiites in Iran. When the time came to divide the profits, the Turk came up with a different count than my brother. The dispute concluded when the Turk planted his knife up to its very fancy hilt in Kirill's stomach.
May he rest in peace, said Manny. My brother or the Turk?
Did the Turk die too?
In this part of the world it is not honorable to let the person who kills your brother continue living.
Whatever, Manny mumbled in English.
He settled onto a bench, leaned his back against the wall, and studied Konstantin, who was neatly dressed in trousers and a double-breasted suit jacket and a white shirt, buttoned up to the neck.
What is with you in the wheelchair?
My legs are paralyzed, Konstantin said, the result of a knife wound inflicted by the same Turk who killed my brother, but my spirit is willing.
How willing?
Explain your problem, and we will both of us see how willing.
Manny pointedly eyed the young man sitting at the table.
Konstantin said, He is Kirill's oldest son, and my nephew. You can speak in front of him as you would in front of me.
Manny explained that he and three others needed to cross the Soviet border without going through the formality of having their passports stamped. Konstantin backed one wheel of his chair and looked at his nephew. The young man pulled a small notebook from the breast pocket of his worn double-breasted jacket. He moistened a thumb and flipped the pages until he came to the one he wanted, and consulted a list written in a microscopic handwriting.
The Greek freighter Thessaloniki is due to sail for the Bosporus and Athens with a cargo of raw timber on tomorrow night's tide, he informed his uncle.
If the Thessaloniki is carrying timber, Manny said, thinking out loud, it could be loaded into the hold in such a way as to leave a hollow space in the middle of the cargo.
It could be, Konstantin noted,
but such an arrangement would be expensive.
Manny spread his hands wide.
What about doing it for old time's sake?
Konstantin wheeled his chair up to Manny. The two men stared into each other's eyes. A person who performs for ideals can always be talked around to see the logic of a different idealism. A person who performs for money, on the other hand, is serving himself and can therefore be trusted. This is something Mr. Pressman in Istanbul used to understand.
Manny brought up another laugh.
I still do, he said.
How much?
Konstantin wheeled back his chair and studied Manny as if he were estimating what the traffic would bear.
There is my nephew here who will approach the ship's captain on my behalf, he said, ticking items off on his fat fingers. There is the ship's captain who must organize with the Greeks to get you ashore. There are his two mates who must be enticed to keep their mouths shut. There is the operator of the crane who will load the timber in such a way as to leave a hollow space in the center. And there is yours truly, the last of the brothers Karamazov, without whom nothing can be done.
The total comes to $2,500 a head, or its equivalent in any convertible currency for you and each of your friends, payable in advance. Manny knew better than to haggle. The price could always go up. He stretched out one of his hands. Konstantin, smiling, nodding, strained forward in his wheelchair to reach for it. At midnight of the second night at sea, the captain and the two mates of the Thessaloniki heaved aside some of the timbers so that the four passengers could come up for air.
They were taken to the first mate's cabin, where they showered and put on clean clothing provided by the captain. Cold chicken and glasses of grape juice were set out on a table. While the others were eating, the captain, with a jerk of his head, invited Manny to step into the passageway. Kicking closed the cabin door behind him, the captain cleared his throat. "It is a matter of fact," he announced, "that we are clear of Soviet territorial waters." Manny nodded warily. "It is a matter of fact," the captain continued, "that even if the Russians knew you were aboard, they could not stop us and take you off." "Whatever." Manny understood that the captain, whose name was Papavlakopoulos, had not taken him aside to pass the time of day. Captain Papavlakopoulos slid his right hand inside his double-breasted blue jacket with faded gold stripes peeling from the sleeves and scratched at his chest through a black turtleneck sweater, which logically brings up the matter of the second installment on your passage money, he said. From the moment he set eyes on him, Manny had not liked the looks of Captain Papavlakopoulos. He smiled too often, and the smiles lasted too long to suggest friendliness. Two gold teeth glistened like fangs on either side of his jaw when he smiled. Manny wouldn't have been surprised to learn that the captain actually stood in front of a mirror and polished them. On top of everything, his eyebrows didn't stir. They might have been painted on his forehead for all the emotion they conveyed. "What is your given name?" Manny asked politely. "I do not understand." There was another smile, another flash of gold teeth, followed by a delicate shrug. "I am called Epaminondas." "Well, listen up, Epaminondas. You know there is no second installment, and I know you know. So why would I want to pay more for a ticket I already bought? Explain me that." "We are speaking man to man, no? We do not need to dance around a bush. The second installment is for insurance. A man sneaking out of Russia would be a fool not to take out insurance, no? A woman, too. Accidents happen, especially on ships. It has arrived for passengers to fall overboard and get chewed up in the screws. They yell for help, but nobody hears them." Manny shook his head, as if he were having trouble believing his ears. "Insurance?" The smile vanished from the captain's face. The eyebrows, which never moved, suddenly inclined slightly inward. "Insurance, yes." Manny snickered. "If someone on board this tub needs insurance, Epaminondas, it's you. An hour after your ship ties up, a telephone had better ring in the back room of a second-floor loft." Manny named a street in Piraeus where a CIA mailbox had been located for years, hoping it was still there, hoping the address was familiar to the captain. "Or you are a dead man. You have a wife? If we don't show up in Greece, take my advice. Draw up a last testament giving her permission to remarry." Manny managed another snicker, this one colder, more deadly than the first. "If my colleagues in Athens don't get you, my friend in Rostov, Konstantin, the last of the brothers Karamazov, will." The captain studied Manny's face for some hint that he was bluffing. Finding none, his own eyes flickered to the deck. "You don't hold it against a man taking the temperature of the water?" "In your shoes, I would have done the same thing," Manny muttered. The captain smiled. The two gold teeth flashed out a message of relief. After dinner, Aida slipped out of the cabin and climbed onto a wing of the bridge. A fresh headwind was stirring up sheets of fine spray from the bow wave. Overhead, a crescent of a moon knifed silently through wisps of clouds. The ship was navigating between the banks of the Bosporus. Land was a long stone's throw to starboard and to port. From the stern of the Thessaloniki came the throaty squawk of gulls darting in and out of the ship's wake. Aida, her hair hanging loose and tangling in gusts of wind, leaned over the railing to watch them. "We are being squeezed out of Asia like dental paste from a tube," she thought. She stared at the phosphorescent wake, trying to imagine it stretching like a broad avenue all the way back through the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov to Temerniskaya Tamozhnya. She found herself toying with the agate ring that was supposed to banish fear. Her watch, she knew, might be running backward, but time was running relentlessly forward on the ship, carrying her with each passing moment farther and farther away from her mother, her Russia. At midnight of the third night at sea, the captain of the Thessaloniki hove to off Piraeus to wait for the boat that would bring the pilot
and take off his four passengers. When the red over white lights of a pilot boat's mast appeared, bobbing on the Aegean, Manny led the way down the steep ladder to the gangway. The pilot, a short man dressed in a white suit with wine stains on the lapels, vaulted onto the landing and saluted the four of them. "We do not get many Russians seeking political asylum these days," he said in precise Oxford English. "Welcome to the world where it is better to be in the black than the red." It was the pilot who directed them to a small boarding house on the outskirts of Piraeus. "The proprietor is the sister of my sister-in-law. Her rates are outrageous, but breakfasts and dinners are included, and more often than not she forgets to register guests with the police." The boarding house, a stucco building bleached white in the Aegean sun with purple patches of bougainvillea clinging like leeches to the walls, sat on a saddle of rocky land above Piraeus, which sprawled below in a tangle of streets around the port. White-whiskered billy goats foraged in a nearby municipal garbage dump. On the skyline, disjointed slivers of the Acropolis shimmered in waves of heat rising from Athens. Ben and Aida, worn out mentally as well as physically, slept late. Sava and Manny were up and about when the cock crowed. Sava went off to play with the billy goats. Manny went off to negotiate with the powers that be at the American Embassy. He returned early in the afternoon, exhausted from the effort of dealing with the embassy. After a frustrating start, he had talked the ambassador into bringing Washington into the picture. Enciphered messages had been exchanged. The president's national security advisor had come on the line. Guarantees had been offered. The rogue unit in the bowels of the Pentagon would be quietly disbanded. There would be no publicity, no acknowledgement that it had existed, no hint that there had been a plot to topple Gorbachev lest American credibility be undermined. Could Custer and Bassett be counted on to cooperate? They could, Manny cabled back, for a consideration, which Manny spelled out. The National Security Advisor quickly cabled back his agreement. Inkerman would be retired out of the service for permitting an unauthorized operation to go on under his nose. Manny would be pensioned off without prejudice. Bassett would be offered back his old job at Army Intelligence. Aida would get the bone marrow transplant for Sava, after which she could settle in the country of her choice. Manny explained all this to Ben and Aida, and then, excusing himself, retired to his room. He planned to sleep until the fall, he said. "Do not disturb," he said, "ever again." He had had it up to here with Foreign Service officers motivated by an abstract concept of serving their country without having any real sense of what that country stood for. For many of them, it stood for whatever the president of the moment said it stood for. Screw them, screw the world, whatever. The sister of the pilot's sister-in-law, a former nightclub singer who piped tapes of her off-key performances into the dining room over a loudspeaker, packed a picnic lunch in a straw hamper, and Ben, Aida, and Sava hiked up to the hill from which Xerxes was said to have watched the Battle of Salamis. "So," Aida instructed Sava, pointing to the narrow strait between the island of Salamis and the mainland, "all this took place 500 years before Jesus died on the cross. The Persian king Xerxes built a bridge of rafts across the Hellespont to launch Asia's first invasion of Europe." "And did he succeed?" Sava asked. "He sacked Athens," Aida explained. "Then he set up a throne here on this hill, perhaps on this very spot, and watched while the outnumbered Greek fleet destroyed his ships in the strait at his feet. And that was the beginning of the end of his invasion of Europe." "If he saw that his ships were losing," Sava wanted to know, "why didn't he call off the battle?" "Even kings sometimes have trouble changing the course of history," Aida noted. "Maybe that's just as well," Ben put in. Aida nodded in fervent agreement. "Maybe." While Sava scampered after butterflies, Ben and Aida sat with their backs to a stunted olive tree, looking out at the tramp steamers and fishing boats crisscrossing the Aegean. At length, Ben offered her a grin, but his heart wasn't in it. "History has a built-in echo," he observed. "My grandfather, the one who wound up, ancient before he was old, operating a projector in a Bronx motion picture theater, stowed away on a steamer bound for Istanbul, one jump ahead of the Cheka, hunting him as an enemy of the people. And here I am, trailing in his footsteps, sneaking across the frontier one step ahead of the KGB. "Your grandfather should have stayed in Russia," remarked Aida. "He would have been shot.
Akhmatova said you should die with your country as opposed to for your country. Aida turned the agate ring on her finger. When Sava has had his operation, he and I are going back to our Russia. Ben studied the wakes crisscrossing the sea. He was amazed that they persisted in the water long after the ships that produced them had disappeared over the horizon. What will become of us? He asked Aida. There is no longer an us, she announced in a hollow voice. Her jaw trembled. I have betrayed poetry. In a manner of speaking, you have betrayed prose. We are wandering, lost, on an endless steppe. Ben stared into her gray animal eyes, memorizing the pain in them. He remembered spiraling out of character on the steps of the Druzhba Cafe the day he first met her. He remembered the words that had gushed out, I hope to Christ we do not meet again. He remembered her talking about the incident later. One day you will tell me a truth as intently as you did outside the cafe, she had said. I hope I will believe you when you do. Now, he needed to tell her another truth as intently as he could, so that she would believe it, believe him. In the beginning, I went through the motions of being in love with you, he admitted, but I am not going through motions now. His hand reached for hers, found it, cold and limp. I am not acting. I love you, Aida. I love Sava. I can't lose you both, again. I beg you to believe me, to trust me one more time. She searched his eyes. The ever-present lucidity seemed clouded by passion. I believe you love me, Benedict. I believe you love Sava, and I will not deny that I love you. But lucidity has finally overpowered lust. There were too many betrayals, too many lies. Our past is rotting, and our future, under our feet, there is a terrible carnival of dead leaves. So, I love you, but I do not trust you. I can no longer be sure where our fictions stop and our love starts. I wish to God it were otherwise. On an impulse, Aida picked up a rock the size of her fist and, in a sudden motion, smashed her wristwatch against it. She stared at the broken crystal, then held out her wrist so that Ben could see it. Fate has offered us the gift of a curious coincidence, she said. Remember the story of the friend who stopped the clock when Pushkin died? The hour and the minute hand had also stopped at 2:45. The shattering of the watch, the coincidence, caused a dam to rupture. Aida pressed her eyes tightly shut to keep back the tears. Life is finished, she whispered, repeating Pushkin's dying words. It is difficult to breathe. Her body shuddered with a quiet crying. Tears appeared from under the lids of her animal eyes and streamed down her face, leaving traces as persistent as the wakes in the sea. Four people whose names would not have meant anything to the general public gathered around a table in a basement room in the Pentagon. The table was metal and covered with frayed green felt, the room windowless, stuffy, remote. If I know my man Spink, the former CIA station chief who went by the name of Marlowe, he would have produced a bottle of Jack Daniels. Lining up four paper cups undoubtedly swiped from some water cooler, he would have poured a healthy shot into each and handed them around. I can see him raising his paper cup in toast. I can hear him saying, "Here's to us. We have dammed a river. We have diverted history." According to a security log I was not supposed to see, this was the final meeting of a shadowy Pentagon organization listed innocuously as Intelligence Support Activity. Nursing his Jack Daniels, the group's Eminence Grise would have asked the man he knew as Marlowe to bring him up to date on the principles. Once the boy Sava recovered from the operation, he and the lady poet disappeared back into Russia, Marlowe would have reported. I personally convinced Bassett that Custer had gotten it all wrong, that thanks to him we have discredited the opposition to Glasnost and Perestroika after all. He's been posted to Wyoming by our friends in Army Intelligence, who promised to keep an eye on him. As for Custer, he is depositing his retirement checks in a small bank in Vermont. I understand he is hard at work on a book about what happened in Moscow.
The Eminence Grise, who was something of an innocent when it came to tradecraft, probably frowned. How did you find out about the book?
Marlowe must have smirked with pleasure. Walls, as Custer liked to say, have ears.
Custer was overheard saying he is going to try to get a friend who writes spy novels to publish his book as fiction. That way the affidavits he signed giving the company prior review rights to anything he wrote would not come into play.
Can we live with this? The Eminence Grise would have inquired.
Marlowe would have shrugged. Who is going to read fiction as disguised fact?
Who indeed? The former CIA deputy director surely agreed with a grin.
At some point, the Marine colonel attached to the long-term planning staff of the Joint Chiefs would certainly have made a formal announcement. I am authorized to convey to you all a Bravo Zulu. In the Navy, that stands for well done. I am also authorized to remind you that it is the only recognition you will ever get. Except that when we read the newspapers, I can hear the former CIA deputy director remarking, we will know the reality behind the headlines. Here's to the reality behind the headlines, the Marlowe I know and detest would not have resisted commenting. Whatever happens, the Marine colonel is supposed to have warned, we must never speak of what we did in this room to anyone, never hint at it in our memoirs. We have every reason to believe the bait we planted was swallowed. We would be fools to put the operation, or ourselves, or American credibility at risk at this point. The four men whose names would not have meant anything to the general public would have quietly polished off the last of the Jack Daniels in the cups. Knowing how Marlowe operates, I'd bet the usual scotch on the usual rocks that, as the meeting broke up, he carefully collected the paper cups from the table, metal, covered with frayed green felt, so there would be no trace of anyone having been in the room, windowless, stuffy, remote. Author's note. The publisher, acting on the advice of nervous lawyers, has asked the author to include the usual disclaimer, has made its inclusion, if I got the tone of the request right, a condition of publication. For the record, fellas, the characters are figments of someone's imagination. Any resemblance to folks living or dead is pure coincidence. As for the story, it has obviously been invented. Everyone knows that such things don't happen in real life. Whatever. End of An Agent in Place by Robert Little. Narrated by George Backman in the studios of American Foundation for the Blind Incorporated for the Library of Congress, April 1993. For special distribution as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522, with the permission of the copyright holder and the publisher, Bantam Books, a division of Bantam Doubleday Dell Publishing Group, Incorporated, 666 Fifth Avenue, New York, New York, 10103. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.